Rachel Naomi Remen is one of the wise people in our world. I quote from my conversation with her all the time. She's a physician and a lyrical writer whose long struggle with Crohn's disease has shaped her view of life and medicine. Living well, she says, is not about eradicating our wounds and weaknesses, but understanding how they complete our identity and equip us to help others. The way we deal with losses, large and small, shapes our capacity to be present to all our experiences. And there's a difference, she says, between curing and healing.
We thought we could cure everything, but it turns out that we can only cure a small amount of human suffering. The rest of it needs to be healed, and that's different. It's different. I think science defines life in its own way, but life is larger than science. Life is filled with mystery, courage, heroism, love, all these things that we can witness but not measure or even understand, but they make our lives valuable anyway.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. You grew up, I believe, as you say, surrounded by doctors and one mystic.
Doctors, a few nurses, and few one nurses. Mystic. It's true.
That would have been your Orthodox rabbi grandfather.
Mm-hmm. And student of Kabbalah.
Student of Kabbalah before it was a fashion trend.
Very much so. Oh, and he was a flaming mystic, and he was also a magnificent storyteller.
Well, what do you mean when you say he was a flaming mystic? I mean, describe that to me.
What that means? Oh, it means many different things. Mm-hmm. It can mean a scholarly thing, like the study of a school of mysticism like Kabbalah. But it's also a way of seeing the world. My grandfather felt that the world was in constant communication with him, that there was a spirit in the world, a God in the world, that could be spoken to and could respond at all times, that there was a presence in the world that was holy and sacred, and that he was in constant dialogue with this as he went through the events of his day. I think mysticism can be defined in many different ways. I didn't know that my grandfather was a mystic.
No.
I just knew that the world that he lived in was the world I wanted to live in, too.
You recount this idea of the Kabbalah, which I had known, but I don't know, I think maybe because you're a storyteller, it was very vivid for me, that this idea that at the beginning of the creation, the holy was broken up, right?
Oh, the story
flew
of the birthday
into sparks
of the world.
At the beginning of things. And you know,
the story of the birthday of the world, yes.
Is that how he told it to you?
Yes, exactly.
And how would he describe it?
Actually, Krista, this was my fourth birthday present, this story. Mm. And if you'd like, I'll tell it to
yes,
you.
Yes, do.
Yeah. So this is the story of the birthday of the world. In the beginning, there was only the holy darkness, the Ein Sof, the source of life. And then in the course of history, at a moment in time, this world, the world of 1,000,000 things, emerged from the heart of the holy darkness as a great ray of light. And then, perhaps because this is a Jewish story, there was an accident.
Okay.
And the vessels containing the light of the world, the wholeness of the world, broke. And the wholeness of the world, the light of the world, was scattered into 1,000,000 fragments of light. And they fell into all events and all people, where they remain deeply hidden until this very day. Hmm. Now, according to my grandfather, the whole human race is a response to this accident, We are here because we are born with the capacity to find the hidden light in all events and all people, to lift it up and make it visible once again, and thereby to restore the innate wholeness of the world. This is a very important story for our times, that we heal the world one heart at a time, restoring the world.
Is there a connection between the story of the sparks and Tikkun Olam in Jewish tradition? Are they bound together?
They're exactly the same.
I did not know
that those two come
together. Tikkun
Olam is the restoration. Yeah,
right.
It's the restoration of the world.
Right.
And this is, of course, a collective task.
Hmm.
It involves all people who have ever been born, all people presently alive, all people yet to be born. We are all healers of the world.
Hmm.
And that story opens a sense of possibility. It's not about healing the world by making a huge difference. It's about healing the world that touches you.
Right.
That's around you.
That world
and
to which you have.
And that's where our power is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, many people feel powerless in today's situation.
Right. I mean, when you use a phrase like that, just out of nowhere, heal the world, it mm-hmm. sounds like a dream, right? And a nice, sweet, ideal, completely impossible.
It's a very old story. It comes from the 14th century.
Mm.
And it's a different way of looking at our power. And I suspect it has a key for us in our present situation, a very important key.
Say some more about that. Think that through for me.
Well, you know, I don't want to talk politics here. I'm not a person who is a political person in the usual sense of that word. But I think that we all feel that we're not enough to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to be more somehow, either wealthier or more educated or somehow or other different than the people we are. And according to this story, we are exactly what's needed. And to just wonder about that a little, what if we were exactly what's needed?
Mm.
What then? How would I live if I was exactly what's needed to heal the world?
Mm.
And I think these kinds of questions are very important questions.
And exactly what's needed is precisely the given story of your life.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And, you know, the story, people will say about a story like the story of Tikkun Olam, the birthday of the world, well, you know, how can I make a difference when I'm so wounded myself?
Mm-hmm.
How can I make a difference when I feel so not enough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's our very wounds that enable us to make a difference. We are the right people just as we are. For example, my own wounds, my own sufferings, have enabled me to feel compassion for the sufferings of others. Without my suffering, I wouldn't understand the suffering of others or be able to connect to them. My loneliness enables me to recognize the loneliness in other people, even when it's covered over, to find them where they have become lost in the dark and sit with them and to know that just by sitting with them, eventually they will find what they need in order to move forward.
What have you learned through your work with other physicians, your attempt to listen to other physicians and to kind of, let's say, work on the healing of the field of medicine? Now, how did that come about, that you started doing that actively?
Well, there are a couple of, again, you know, the next step appears. In listening to the people with cancer at the retreats, I would hear stories about their experience with the medical system and with the people in it. And every so often, someone would go back and tell their doctor what they had experienced at the retreat, and the doctor would call. And I was the medical director. I am the medical director still of the retreat. And the doctor would say, "Aren't you doing anything like this for us?"
Right.
I began to realize how wounded I had been by my training. The training is abusive. It's very, very, very difficult experience.
Medical school.
It's a 24/7 medical school and medical training. It goes on for years, seven, eight years, you know. And I began to realize how I had been healed by these people with cancer, how I had moved from a person focused on curing and truly coming to understand that we are all healers of one another, that people have been healing each other since the beginning, and that my power to cure was a small part of my power to help people. And wanting to help my profession as well. The people who go into medicine are extraordinary. You know, I developed a course called The Healer's Art. Gosh, that was 1992. And I taught it at UCSF. It's a very unusual course. It's an experiential course. They usually don't do these things, certainly not back then in medical school.
Right.
And it's about enabling young people to recognize that who they are is as important as what they know in terms of what they're going to be able to make a difference in people's lives. It is validating for students the human agenda in illness. It reminds them that healing is a different relationship than a curing relationship. And it reminds them of their power to make a difference through their human response and connection to their patients. It basically reminds the students of the lineage of medicine. You know, I happen to see medicine as a spiritual path. That's my personal thing. That medicine is a spiritual path, which is characterized by compassion, harmlessness, service, reverence for life, courage and love. The basic qualities of the Hippocratic Oath are not scientific qualities. They're the qualities of human relationship, and they are spiritual qualities, very profound spiritual qualities. And we remind the students of the lineage. And this is young students. And we enable them to see that they belong to it exactly as they are, that they are already the right people to become physicians. All they need to do is learn the science and learn the facts without allowing themselves to be changed by that process in any way.
What is it in that process? I mean, it seems ironic, and the stories you tell about how destructive medical school can be seem ironic. We do think of people who go to medical school, as you say, as extraordinary. And
they
as
are.
People who are giving themselves over to this profession that is about healing. And what you describe is an experience that is...
We learn how to cure.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is changing. I mean, obviously, 10 years ago, this course would not be in any of these schools. UCSF was forward-looking enough to give it a home, you know. But I think the world is changing. I think we're recognizing the limitations of our science. Our science, you know, that little phrase, living better through science. There's no question that we live better through science. But to live well is going to take something more than that. I mean, if I look at myself, without the 8 major surgeries and the many medications, and I still take many medications that keep me alive, I wouldn't be here. But with only these things, I'd be an invalid.
Right. I wanted to ask a minute ago when you said you think about medicine as a spiritual path. And yet it seems that medicine is also a science, at least in our culture, and it seems that at some point and somehow the science overwhelmed, or the scientific mindset, even among those of us who are outsiders, how we view science, overwhelmed whatever spiritual element there is in that.
Well, you know, you have to understand how natural that is. I mean, when I tell you about myself, when I was a child, I had severe otitis media.
Okay. An ear infection.
And developed an abscess in the bone of my skull.
Oh, gosh.
And sulfa drugs were available in the nick of time. And that power was a very heady power. We could do, there was insulin for people with diabetes. I mean, you should have to think about what this meant.
Mm-hmm. All of this, you've seen all of this in your lifetime.
Oh my God, yes. Mm-hmm. This meant a huge amount for people. We thought we could cure everything.
Right.
But it turns out that we can only cure a small amount of human suffering. The rest of it needs to be healed, and that's different. It's different. I think science defines life in its own way, but life is larger than science. Life is filled with mystery, courage, heroism, love, all these things that we can witness but not measure or even understand,
mm-hmm.
but they make our lives valuable anyway.
And I would say the destructive aspects of life are also mysterious and unmeasurable, right? I mean, we can also observe evil and...
I think that's true. Of course that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the issue is not to eradicate evil. I'm not sure evil can be eradicated. I think it's part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is to commit yourself to what's important to you.
Something that I found interesting, and as you've written, the way we deal with loss shapes our capacity to be present to life more than anything else. The way we protect ourselves from loss may be the way in which we distance ourselves from life.
I think this is absolutely correct.
That is such a shocking thought, really.
I think it's correct. I also think that no one is comfortable with loss.
Mm-hmm.
That being that we're a technological culture, our wish or our first response, let's put it this way, our first response to loss is try and fix it. When we are in the presence of a loss that cannot be fixed, which is a great many losses, we feel helpless and uncomfortable, and we have a tendency to run away, either emotionally or actually distance ourselves. Yeah. And fixing is too small a strategy to deal with loss.
Right.
You know. What we teach the students is something very simple.
The medical students?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We teach them the power of their presence, of simply being there and listening and witnessing another person and caring about another person's loss, letting it matter. Letting it matter. We do 6 hours on loss, 2 3-hour sessions, and the students have a very simple instruction, which is they are asked to remember a story of loss from their own lives, and loss, let's put it differently, a time when things didn't go their way, when they were disappointed,
mm-hmm.
when they lost a dream, or a relationship, or even a family member, right? A death,
mm-hmm.
you know? They get to choose that. And then they spend 6 hours in small groups talking about their loss. And the group has one instruction, listen generously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, prior to this exercise, we do another exercise with them where we ask them to remember a time of disappointment and loss and to remember someone who helped them. What did that person do? What did they say? What message did they deliver that was helpful to them at a hard time in their lives? And they write these things down very concretely. And then we ask them to remember a time of loss in their lives and remember someone who wanted to help them but was not of help to them. What did that person do and say, and what message did they deliver, and how did they deliver the message? And they write that down. And then we make a big list. What are all the things that helped? Right? Listen to me for as long as I needed to talk. Talk to me in the same way after my loss as they did before my loss.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sat with me, touched me, brought me food, right? What were the things that didn't help? Gave me advice without knowing the full story,
right?
Mm-hmm. Made me feel that the loss was my fault.
Okay.
So we gather up the wisdom about what helps loss to heal from a group of about 100 students and faculty. And it's all very simple stuff. And the only instruction is, listen generously.
Hmm. Again, it takes me back to how we began talking about the power of stories in human lives and your analogy that the stories are the flesh we put on the bones of the facts about our lives. And, you know, I also hear, I think it's so powerful to just to think about this obvious fact, but again, one of these obvious facts we don't name very often, that loss is not just catastrophic death. It's that there are many different kinds of losses in our lives all the time. And then this kind of stunning idea that you bring forth that the way we deal with those losses, large and small, can really help or get in the way of the way we deal with the rest of our lives, with what we have, right? Not just what we've lost.
I think this is so. I really do. I feel, let me put this. Most people try to hold on to the thing that is no longer part of their lives. And they stop themselves in their lives in that way. I have come to see loss as a stage in a process. It's not the bottom line. It's not the end of the story. What happens next is very, very important. And, you know, people respond to losses in different ways. When I first became ill, I was enraged. I hated all the well people. I felt that I was a victim and this was unfair, right? I was angry for about 10 years. I think all of that anger was my will to live, expressed in a very negative way. And people often are angry in the setting of a terrible loss. They often feel envious of other people. And this is a starting place. But over time, things evolve and change. And at the very least, people who have lost a great deal can recognize that they are not victims, they are survivors. They are people who have found the strength to move through something unimaginable to them, perhaps, in the past. And just asking people that question, you have suffered a really deep loss. What have you called upon for your strength? Most people haven't even noticed their strength. They're completely focused on their
loss.
Pain,
mm-hmm.
on their pain. And isn't that natural, Krista?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's something very hopeful all the way through your writing, even when it is about loss and the hard, dark side of being human. I mean, you do insist, and I'm not sure that modern psychiatry insists on this, that integrity is achievable for everyone. That you see it come to people, and sometimes it comes to people in crisis. You say wholeness is never lost, it is only forgotten.
Wholeness includes all of our wounds.
Mm-hmm.
It includes all of our vulnerabilities. It is our authentic self. And it doesn't sit in judgment on our wounds or our vulnerabilities. It simply says, this is the way we connect to one another. Often we connect through our wounds, through the wisdom we have gained, the growth that has happened to us because we have been wounded allows us to be of help to other people. So it's not a moral judgment. Integrity simply means what is true. To live from the place in you that has the greatest truth. And that truth is always evolving as well.